Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Freud in Focus, a podcast from the Freud Museum London, hosted by me, Tom DeRose. And this week, I'm delighted to say that we're going to be joined by a very familiar voice to listeners of our podcast over previous seasons. I'm really delighted to welcome back my dear friend and colleague, Jamie Ruiz, to the programme. So, Jamie, welcome back.
Hello. Very nice to be back.
great to see you. Great to hear you as well, for those obviously for us who are listening. And so Jamie is going to be speaking today in conversation with me about our current exhibition that's going on at the Freud Museum, currently on Freud and Latin America, and it's going to be on till the 14th of July. And Jamie is the curator of the exhibition and also editor of the very beautiful catalogue that we have available through the Freud Museum shop, beautifully illustrated catalogue. So you can order a copy of the catalogue, as I said, through the Freud Museum shop. We deliver internationally. So it's a very nice present, very colourful, nice present to give yourself in with the spring months just upon us. So just to contextualise where we are with this particular series. So we're in series 5 of Freud in Focus. And traditionally, Jamie and I, of course, have been analysing Freud's texts quite closely across these series. But this particular series was really all about some of the activities that the museum has been putting on over the last year or so. We've spoken about exhibitions, about events, about conferences, just to give kind of listeners an idea of the breadth of the programming that the Freud Museum seeks to put on. So today is our final episode in this series. And as I said, Jamie is going to be talking about her exhibition on Freud and Latin America, which I think is a perfect way really to sum up the kind of creative and broad and wide-ranging thinking really that goes on at the Freud Museum. And the way that we seek to kind of think about psychoanalysis and the Freudian tradition in a global sense, as much as anything else, I guess. So, Jamie, I'm gonna hand over to you straight away. Really, could you just give us an idea of some of the inspiration behind the exhibition itself? Some of those ideas that underpin the research and the people that were involved, really, in the beginnings of this idea that came to you a few years ago, I know, about putting on this special exhibition on Freud and Latin America.
Sure. So, I mean, all of us at the Freud Museum pretty much all started working there in the shop. And that includes you and I, Tom.
Yep, absolutely.
And and when you're working in the shop, you're sort of selling the tickets to the visitors. And you're the first person a visitor sees or speaks to when they visit. And I remember all those years ago when you and I were working in there, and probably say every maybe fourth, fifth person that walked through the door was either Spanish or Portuguese speaking. And it's from that started to like pique my curiosity, like, you know, why is this the case? And you start to ask them questions. Predominantly, they were from Argentina or Brazil. Mm-hmm. More than anywhere else, although we did have visitors from Mexico, from Chile, and of course from Spain and Portugal as well, but overwhelmingly it was from Argentina and Brazil. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember, Tom, as well, actually having to learn some phrases for the shop.
Oh, well, very badly, I think you probably had more facility in that than I did, but yeah, I do remember.
But even, you know, like from someone completely unable to speak Portuguese, and I still remember one of them, you know, se quer um caixa, would you like a box, was a very helpful phrase.
I didn't get any further than tuta bay. Or...
And in 2020, when the museum closed its doors due to COVID, we started to meet a lot more people online. And one of those people that I met was a man named Mariano Rupertus, who was a researcher and a psychoanalyst from Santiago in Chile. And he proposed giving a talk, and I thought, that's great. And I attended and chaired his presentation, which was held online. And I was so blown away by the research, which actually answered so many questions as to why, or gave a much better insight as to why these kind of Latin American visitors were such regularly in attendance at the museum. Mm-hmm. And it's because of this kind of really warm, early reception to Freud throughout the region. And just over time, I started to investigate, over the next few months, started to investigate some of the things that Mariano presented in his paper, which was on the history of psychoanalysis in Latin America. And I managed to find that there was just quite a lot of content in our library. There were a few objects in our collection as well, in Freud's collection of antiquities. And from that, a kind of exhibition started to develop. And we got in touch with a co-author of Mariano's book, Estimado Dr. Freud, which he wrote with Mariano Plotkin, who is from a researcher and historian from Buenos Aires in Argentina. And the three of us started to formulate this exhibition together. So that was really the kind of early grounding of it. But, you know, it comes from a very organic place of engaging with our audience.
Yeah, it's really, it's one of the things that I think, you know, looking back on those kind of days of working in the shop and greeting all these people, of course, it's still a massive percentage of our audience, both in-house and online, comes from the region. And I think that kind of that idea of something happening organically, which comes from almost visitor engagement, you know, originally, you know, is something I think that is something that really defines a kind of an understanding of an audience and a kind of the way that the museum attempts to kind of develop and grow, you know, its research and its ideas from that kind of, you know, that dialogue really with audiences, you know, listening to what people want to talk about, what's going on out there, rather than being a kind of narrow affiliated organization. We look to have a kind of open and broad view of things, and actually that brings me on quite nicely to a comment that I wanted to share with you actually, and I know you're aware of this comment as well, because when we were advertising the exhibition on social media, and it was one of the best liked kind of and most retweeted and most positively commented upon social media campaigns that we've done really in this exhibition. But we used an image of the couch, of Freud's couch, which was covered by a very colourful rug by the artist Santiago Borja, the Mexican artist Santiago Borja, who had this as part of an exhibition in the Freud Museum, so covering the rug with this very colourful carpet and surround. And that was used as a kind of main image in our advertising. And actually, in your exhibition, you've got a beautiful kind of blow-up kind of photo of that on the stairs as you walk up the museum stairs. Very dramatic, very colourful, very bright, very kind of joyful, actually, in many ways, I think. So we use this image as part of our social media campaign. And one comment, an anonymous comment we got back, and which I found very interesting, actually, was someone said that we don't want any of this decolonial psychoanalysis. What we want is classical psychoanalysis. Now I'm sharing this comment now not for any reason of judgment or anything like that, or criticism, but I think it's a really good place to start thinking from, right, and reflecting back on the process of putting on an exhibition like this, you know, and thinking about what classical psychoanalysis might mean as opposed to decolonial psychoanalysis. Thinking about, you know, really those questions about who owns psychoanalysis, who is psychoanalysis for? You know, is it something which is kind of from Middle Europa and then moves across to, you know, those centres in London and New York and those societies which have very kind of rigid frameworks of interpretation and various other things, the schools and disciplines of psychoanalysis in the societies? Or is it something that's maybe less stable and slightly more fluid and slightly more kind of adaptable, really, and changeable, a bit like the concept of the unconscious that Freud starts with and psychoanalysis seeks to kind of unravel, really. You know, so what is psychoanalysis? is it fixed? Is it stable? Or is it a practice which, in a way, automatically unravels itself? Bit of a kind of way, a different way of thinking about definitions, perhaps. But I wonder if any of these questions were in your mind when you were thinking about, you know, what psychoanalysis is, you know, who does it belong to?
Yeah, I mean, just when you were kind of listing those original or historical bases for psychoanalysis, sort of the schools in Vienna and London and Berlin and Paris and stuff, you know, for the last several decades, the highest proportion of psychoanalysts in the world has been in Buenos Aires. So it could be said that that is the center of psychoanalysis today.
Yeah. If there is a home.
Exactly. But equally, you know, even in Freud's time, psychoanalysis was always evolving. Like, he was always fighting against himself, which we discovered in our previous series of Freud and Focus. It's like he's constantly like revising what he thought was the treatment or the method or his theory for a particular idea. It was constantly reanalyzing it and coming to new theses, coming to new ideas, notions about it. So it is just this constantly evolving thing. And, you know, even if you look at it from just a kind of as a kind of true practice of just psychoanalysis, even in different parts of the world, to be a registered psychoanalyst is a different thing for every place. And I think as well of like how prolific someone like Mark Soames is today and how integral he is to psychoanalysis, but actually what he does is integrate that with neuroscience. So
right.
It's not a true, there's no, I just don't see how that's like one singular thing. And coming back to Santiago Borja's artwork Over the Stairs, it was from an exhibition that was in 2010, which took place at the Freud Museum for 1 month, where he replaced the Iranian rugs over the couch and behind the couch. He replaced them with rugs that were woven by Huasheca people in central Mexico, whom he worked with. And this was a way of kind of, the sort of concept for this artwork was this idea of sort of criticizing a purely Eurocentric perspective of, Anglophone perspective as well, of psychoanalysis, because it's North America as well as it's European, that it isn't this sort of stagnant thing. And he was working with this community in central Mexico for whom weaving is a form of communication. And if you think about the way in which when we lie on the couch in a session, you know, our form of communication is speaking. And for him, and for them, it was not about speaking. It was about sort of doing this active thing together.
It's interesting as well, Jeremy, sorry, just to cut in as well, you know, Freud uses that kind of metaphor of weaving actually throughout his work. There's a beautiful line from Creative Writers and Daydreaming, I think, where he says that past, present and future are strung together, as it were, by the thread of the wish that runs through them. So it's not, and of course, Anna Freud uses the weaving metaphor a great deal in her work and her practice of weaving. So, I mean, yeah, the weaving, you know, it's not as far away from what we would think, you know. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, not at all. I was just, the only thing I was just going to add was that this particular artwork by Borja is regularly used whenever people talk about sort of decolonization of the couch or of the practice of psychoanalysis. And it was even used last August in the newspaper Le Monde in France.
Oh, yes.
They used it in that newspaper to illustrate an article by Elizabeth Rudinesco, who was writing about the globalization of psychoanalysis. So it's interesting that was like a kind of almost like a triggering point for this person making the comment, that it was something to be challenged, like it was something to be challenged, when actually It's just because maybe we're used to seeing that image as part of an argument now for a decolonialization.
It's very interesting because you think as well, you know, that psychoanalysis, you know, tends to deal in both and rather than either or, doesn't it? I mean, so I mean, the idea that that something can be both classical and non-classical, or both colonial and decolonial. I mean, there's a great great kind of short book chapter by Jean Laplanche called the Unfinished Copernican Revolution, where he talks about the idea that there are tendencies in psychoanalysis that tend towards the old Ptolemaic view of the world, which is a kind of stable, fixed view, and that what Freud introduced is a notion of like the Copernican Revolution. But when you break things apart and you change things, they have a tendency to come back together, of course, you know, and they and stabilize and become fixed, you know. And it's also, it's interesting. I mean, Laplanche's notion in that text is the idea that it's an unfinished revolution, that it has to carry on being destabilized all the time, because that's what psychoanalysis is. It's not it's not the fixity, it's not the fixation, it's not the stability, but it's the unraveling. Which denotes the practice of psychoanalysis and the reality of psychoanalysis. So it's so interesting to think of that becoming a new symbol for something to react against, and something that to get behind, almost. You know, it's a new kind of a new Copernican revolution in a way. And also, as you were saying, it was a kind of triggering for the person who wrote the comment. And, you know, again, this is not in any way to denigrate that comment, because I think it actually throws up a really important set of questions about how we understand and how we interpret differently the practice of psychoanalysis. But it's also a kind of a retroactive cause, maybe, of your own exhibition as well. You know, these seeds were sown back then, and then, you know, they go on, they come up again, don't they, and they repeat themselves, you know, and that nothing more psychoanalytic than things repeating in different ways across time. So so taking that, Jamie, that idea of maybe that problematic of stability, yeah, definition. One thing that I know that you were thinking a great deal about at the beginning of the exhibition, and part of the exhibition goes into this, is the idea of defining what we can mean by the phrase Latin America. You know, how does that represent the region, and is it a kind of colonial gesture to use a phrase like that? You know, how do we define and what are the challenges by using a definition in a kind of such a wide and kind of, you know, and various region, I guess, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting point, just because it's so complex. Like, it covers huge, like, geographical terrains, Latin America, you know, from this kind of arid landscapes to kind of tropical rainforests. And then it has all these political boundaries within it. Mm. And then within those political boundaries, you have millions of cultures that sort of are sort of seeped into all these different countries. And of course, Latin America being quite different to South America, because South America excludes Mexico. Right. And that's a really important part of the narrative, that we included Mexico. But of course, even within, you know, I think to be phrasing it as Latin America sort of hones in quite closely on language.
Yes.
And Latin America refers to the sort of predominantly to the Romantic languages, Spanish, Portuguese, native language countries. Which are the kind of national languages, but within them they have loads of other languages as well. So this was really difficult to identify, but at the same time, it kind of completes a whole story by including all of them, because when I was working with the Mariano, it's like one of the key points is how it was an exchange of ideas between the different between the different cultures and people. You know, Chilean analysts were talking to Brazilian analysts, who were talking to Argentinians, and it was a network from within the whole region. And you saw this kind of response to psychoanalysis. Not there, it wasn't exactly the same for every country, but it also, they didn't, none of the countries either worked in isolation as well.
So there was a kind of community of exchange. And I mean, are there any kind of, so coming to the exhibition itself there, I mean, in from that position, are there any kind of dominant themes that come that you can see across the region, that kind of, are there any kind of ways of us to understand, you know, how we can put that region together as a kind of unit with a kind of semi-unified response to psychoanalysis, or the way that it shapes and thinks about psychoanalysis?
Yeah, so I think the way that Freud was being transmitted to the general public was quite an important way, because it was quite an important factor in how he was received and how his Freudian psychoanalytic reputation still maintains today, is because it was being integrated at kind of all levels. It wasn't just medical level or just this classical psychoanalytic level. It was in radio shows, it was in magazines, it was in comic books, and you see Freud's theories being almost democratized for the layperson to read or to listen to, or just to understand. And it just seems like one of the ways that that really hit, or from what I noticed from some of the examples that we have in the exhibition, is one of the ways that really hit home was through the analysis of dreams. So it just seemed to sort of really be a bit of a phenomenon culturally, because you see it in we have a couple examples of a women's magazine in Argentina from the around the 40s called Idilio, which was targeted to a female audience, and it was just, you know, kind of like a Cosmo equivalent.
Cosmo of its time.
But they had a regular article which was called Psychoanalysis Will Help You, El Psicoanalysis de Ayudará, and it was illustrated by a Argentine German artist. Each of these articles were illustrated by this artist called Greta Stern, and Greta Stern made these beautiful montages of dreams. Now, the idea was that women read, the female readers would send in their dreams to the magazine, and they would be analyzed by someone with the pseudonym of Richard Rest. And this character, Richard Rest, which was actually two Argentinian psychologists who were sort of expelled from the university by the dictatorships and stuff, they analyzed the dreams in a kind of pop culture-y way, analyzed the dreams in the articles. But what Greta Sturm did was that she didn't represent the kind of analysis of the dream in the artwork. She represented aspects of the dreamer's dream, a scene from the dream, which I think was itself an analysis, was its own interpretation of that person's dream. So it was just lots of kind of meta analysis within it. And then we even have an example of a radio show which took place in Brazil in the 1930s, called The World of Dreams. And this was hosted by a self-proclaimed psychoanalyst called Gastão Pereira da Silva, who was a big believer in lay analysis. And once again, he would invite listeners to sort of send in their dreams, and they would be acted out on a radio theater program. And from the acting out, he would then analyze it and say, like, this was the remnants of your day. You know, this must be the effect of something that happened many years ago, so on.
Wow. Yeah.
We do have examples of it in the exhibition, but they are in Portuguese. So but yeah, it's just really interesting to see how dreams kind of punctured these different cultures. And we even have a comic book from Mexico in the 60s, which was a kind of biographical study of Freud, but through this sort of neo-noir comic book style. And is called Freud, the Wizard of Dreams, El Mago de Sueños. And it's this idea, you know, it's really honing in on Freud's, well, I mean, it looks at his life, but it's honing in on his dream case studies and it illustrates them. So it's just, it, I think this is one of the things that really was a common trend throughout the region.
I mean, and of course, dreams are so crucial. It's the first great book of psychoanalysis, of course, the interpretation of dreams. It's the stuff that really gets Freud ticking and thinking dreams, really, isn't it? That's the, it's the thing that starts him thinking about something to do with the psyche rather than to do with the neurons. You know, it's the way that we represent desire and those sorts of things, the puzzling things that we imagine to ourselves. You know, the dream is so much at the core of classical and inverted commas psychoanalysis. It's the birth of psychoanalysis almost. Irma's injection dream being the play, you know, Freud puts a plaque up, doesn't he, at Bellevue saying this, you know, Sigmund Freud, this is where Sigmund Freud stayed and he first discovered the secret of dreams or something like that. Words to that effect, anyway. So dream, I mean, you can see why dreams would be taken up so universally, I think. And that seems to me very much in the spirit of the kind of early pioneering Freud that is attempting to break out into new grounds and discover things and actually when he says, you know, he's, you know, thinking about folk wisdom, you know, and you know, that's something that Freud specifically says, that, you know, this idea that there's this kind of wisdom in folklore that is slightly displaced and isn't scientific, but it almost has the same impulse or comes to the same conclusion. So that idea that there's meaning in dreams, that we're fascinated by dreams, that they can be productive of creativity and art and stuff, and those images, as you were saying, by Greta Stern are absolutely stunning. And I would encourage anyone, do have a look. And if you can't get to the exhibition, then definitely get yourself a copy of the catalogue, because they're really quite remarkable representations of these kind of, you know, odd, strange kind of, you know, collapsed things coming together, animals, humans, you know, kind of, it's just great. It's so difficult. This is the thing about dreams, isn't it? It's difficult to put them into words, but, you know, captured in on the camera, you know, those things, they come out so beautifully. And of course, you've mentioned that, the radio show as well. So it's a kind of it's an exhibition that obviously is kind of multimedia in that way. We have the visual, the textual, the audio. And so if dreams is something that kind of reaches across a region, and we're calling the region in inverted commas kind of thing, is there anything specific to a particular region, a particular place which stands itself out from that you could talk to us about? Something that kind of might be, you know, that might kind of be specific just to Brazil perhaps, or Argentina?
Very good question. I don't know if I can pinpoint any one thing to either of those countries. I mean, the main outlier actually is, or that I would argue is the main outlier, is Mexico. Because it took a lot longer for psychoanalysis to kick off there. And one of the kind of more interesting stories was that Freud had a correspondence with the judge who persecuted the assassinator of Trotsky. And but other than that, I mean, there's kind of no real links to Mexico and that Freud sort of made throughout his life. And meanwhile, there's this wonderful book, a few years old now, by Ruben Gallo called Freud's Mexico, which I think you can still get online. And it's a really interesting kind of investigation that does set Mexico apart from what else is happening in the more southern countries, because it didn't have as much of a dialogue with what else was happening in Argentina and Brazil, which tended to be quite, they tended to kind of communicate with each other quite well. Mm. But Mexico didn't, and it kind of went in a slightly different direction with it. And he points out the kind of key individuals that took it up and highlights how much later a Mexican psychoanalytic society was opened up compared to Chile, to Argentina, and so on, which all began in the kind of 30s period.
So well before then, well before the appearance of the psychoanalytic societies in Chile and Argentina and Brazil, we have the dissemination of psychoanalysis through popular culture. So it gets popular culture comes first, really, and the stabilization and the instigation of the societies almost is follows on from that in some ways.
Or it sort of coincides with it, really. But the medical circles were already picking up on psychoanalysis before that. And it was these sort of key figures who were medical practitioners, physicians, psychiatrists, who were bringing psychoanalysis to medical fields beforehand. And one of them was this Brazilian doctor named Juliano Moreira, who was a descendant of slaves. He was a black doctor. But as early as kind of 1900, he was practicing, and he came to Europe a few times for congresses and so on. And around 1910, 1913, I believe, he came to a congress in London. And this is where he first heard psychoanalytic ideas. And he was like, okay, well, you know what? This fits in really well because I'm trying to revolutionize the way in which we approach psychiatry in Brazil. And so he adapted some of Freud's theories for these medical treatments for people receiving psychiatric help. And he wanted to kind of advocate that quote unquote madness wasn't genetic. It wasn't based on race or skin color. It was down to situational factors, you know, like a poor hygiene or being unable to access education. Like these are the things that create these inequalities in mental health. And Freud was a part of that. And he ended up opening institutions where he was using psychoanalytic treatments. But you know, this is pre-1920s that he was already engaging with some of these ideas. So it's pretty amazing.
Amazing timing as well. We're thinking about that kind of the kind of socialist aspect of that kind of psychoanalytic engagement, the idea of, you know, housing, cleanliness, these sorts of things, the way that psychoanalysis, you know, it's in 1918 that Freud gives his famous Budapest address about the kind of, you know, the notion of a free psychoanalysis for everyone that could and I actually at this point I'd probably also like to give a shout out to Raluca Soriano's project run under the name of FreeSci that kind of engages and supports and researches free clinics across the world, actually. But you know, a lot of her field work takes place in Brazil. So there's a strong tradition, I think, in the region. Using the word region kind of loosely here again, but that way that the way that psychoanalysis and socialism kind of, you know, intermix, certainly in some aspects of this story. And I would also, before we finish, I'd like to give a shout out to Honorio Delgado, but I'd like to ask you about Freud's only foreign friend, as he described him, or words to that effect. You can correct me on that. Honorio Delgado, whose actually volume is also part of our current book conservation project as well, which you had on display in the exhibition, which is still there, of course. Can you tell us a bit about Delgado and about his relationship to Freud?
Yeah, so Freud was corresponding with a young man who's sort of 20, 30 years his junior, called Honorio Delgado, from around 1919 until the mid-1930s. And they wrote to each other say not as many as 100, but tens of letters, all of which are based in the Library of Congress. If you're interested, you can find them and read them open source online. But Honorio Delgado was a physician in Peru. He is Peruvian, and he got in touch with Freud by letter in 1919, and they started to exchange ideas, and he expressed his heartfelt appreciation for his theories. And Freud replied, and they had this exchange for many, many years. They even exchanged gifts. So there's we have one Peruvian object in the collection, which is on display as part of the exhibition. And this is believed, not confirmed, but believed to have been a gift from Honorio Delgado. But the letters are very interesting because Delgado's tries to engage with him on these kind of like very kind of scientific levels. You know, he was a doctor, and he was trying to kind of get better insight and sort of even debate with Freud on some of his ideas. But Freud always kind of wasn't rude. He was so nice, but almost like too nice. You know, if he was talking to a similar colleague who was from London or from Germany, he'd be challenging them and arguing with them by letter. Like, Freud wrote a letter every like 20 minutes. Like, he was so prolific as a letter writer, but it just seems like with Honorio Delgado, it was just so affectionate on form. And he, I think for him, he really romanticized this idea that his theories were making it in a place that was extremely kind of exotic in his mind. Right. It was so far from, you know, Freud never visited Latin America. I suppose I should have said that at the beginning. He never visited Latin America himself. So for him, this was like this kind of faraway place. But he was just sort of very, I don't know. I think he was thinking about his own posterity going forward. What would his legacy be? Of course, he would like his theories to reach this far flung places of the earth that were very different to where he was from. And I think that's where his sort of warmth and kindness towards Honorio Delgado came from. Delgado visited him in Vienna a couple of times. He most likely brought him these gifts and so on. And we even have a photograph of him in the collection. And there's this letter that Freud writes about the photograph where he says, "Please accept my heartfelt thanks for the picture that arrived here a few days ago. It was a lovely surprise for me, and it will be cherished." Yeah, just, it's so...
Yeah, very evocative. So kind of like, yeah.
But also paints Freud in this kind of, you know, he's not always like on to like kind of debate and argue and fight for his place. He was also just this really kind human sometimes to people. So, yeah. And it's apparently, from what I understand from that letter, is that Delgado asked for an image of him in return. And I know that there's a letter, most likely to one of the Brazilian figures who were sort of advocating psychoanalysis. And Freud sends him a letter and says, "I don't know what you want with my ugly picture." But the photograph of Freud would become a symbol, and it would be a kind of a sign that, you know, you've met the idol.
Mm. Yeah, it's like a certificate, isn't it? I mean, it also brings to mind to me, coming back to, you know, looping back to the beginning of the notion of you know, who is psychoanalysis for and what is it, you know, because as we know that, you know, the early translations of A.A. Brill from the Interpretation of Dreams, you know, Brill was kind of making up dreams in that, you know, and kind of, you know, for the audience, really, I guess, you know, it's not a direct kind of literal word for word translation in that way. And you know, you also get this feeling that Freud wasn't too, you know, there were times when, you know, Freud, like you said, it was an important thing that his legacy and got out there and people understood it. And it wasn't just an ivory tower discipline full of kind of technical terms and et cetera, you know, that it was actually something that could influence, you know, the lives of everyday people. Mm. And, you know, that ideal of 1918 and the Budapest Address, that one day everyone will be able to have, you know, psychoanalysis for free, you know, is a kind of, you know, that socialization of psychoanalysis sets it apart, really, I think, from a kind of a jargonistic, you know, as I said, ivory tower kind of hermetically closed system that it can sometimes be be thought to be or be represented as. So one of the things that I really took from your exhibition, apart from the fact that it was, you know, very, very well researched and presented and beautifully and looked beautiful, is just that kind of that idea of just walking in and seeing how psychoanalysis doesn't just exist in the classical text or on the couch, you know, that there's such a kind of how much of it is infused in culture, you know. And thinking about the region that you took, Latin America, how that is really an example for all of us, really, that how much, you know, popular culture has kind of taken up and how much it's been invested, you know, think of Frasier and you know, kind of in the States and things, you know, that we're so seeped and immersed in psychoanalysis through that dissemination of Freud's theories, ideas, and almost the spirit of curiosity and investigation, and that actually it was a real eye opener for me in that. So Jamie, I think I'm going to sum up in a bit. Was there anything else you'd like to say before we finish? Yeah,
could I finish on just a little quote that I wish we could have included in the exhibition and we didn't, and it's from a column that was published in 1936 by a Chilean journalist and writer called Joaquin Edwards Bayo. And this sort of column was called The Freudians. And it was not this idea, it's a piece that was from Mariano's talk a few years ago, but it really nicely kind of exemplifies that spread of psychoanalysis in Santiago, the capital of Chile, in 1936. He writes, "A few days ago, I was walking down the Alameda when I saw a crowd pouring out of the university. Or rather, I saw a crowd dispersing from the doors. It included girls, youths, and ladies from all classes of society, but it was dominated by the middle class. I couldn't restrain my curiosity, and I asked one of the people leaving what was going on, and I was told that it was a lecture on psychoanalysis." I just think that that's really beautiful, that it was for everybody. It really exemplifies that picture of a kind of democratized practice.
Perfect, perfect. And what a lovely way to finish the episode in this series, indeed, of Freud and Focus. What a better way, no better way to finish than the idea of a democratization of psychoanalysis for the people. You know, long may that continue. And Jamie, I'd just like to say thank you so much for joining me today for this discussion, and congratulations on your exhibition. And for those listeners as well, do try to get down to the museum before the 14th of July to have a look at this amazing story of the spread of psychoanalysis across the region of Latin America. And if you can't get down, and even if you can get down, make sure you get yourself a copy of the catalogue, because we've been talking a lot about visual things, and this is a really beautiful kind of visual object that's really kind of worth poring over. So it's a feast for the eyes and obviously for the intellect as well. So do get yourself a copy of that. You can do that on our online shop. I'm just left to say goodbye, really. So, Jamie, you are going to be joining us again for some more episodes for our next series of Freud and Focus, which we'll be planning and writing together soon. So I'm looking forward to that. So keep an eye out for that. But for now, I'd like to say thank you very much for listening to you all, and hope to see you again, or hope for you to hear us again on the next episode of Freud and Focus. Thank you. Goodbye.